there isn't a wrong time to dump. I think if you see that your team isn't contending, and it's not just where you are in the standings, if you see that you're middle of the pack, but you don't see a lot of opportunities to make it up through trade or make it up through guys coming back from injury, or you have guys overperforming where you're like, well, I know I'm in seventh place, but this just doesn't feel like a seventh place team. This feels like a 10th place team. I think you do what's right for your team. I don't think you worry about the perception of the league that you're dumping too early.
And welcome to episode 57 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Gianella and George Bissell. How are you guys doing on yet another Wednesday evening? An unsuccessful Harvey day.
You know, as a Met fan, I'm kind of sad, but I actually don't have Harvey in any leagues this year, and I hate to say it, I'm starting to get to that point with the Mets where I'm already dejected enough that I haven't completely given up on them, but I'm starting to focus more on my league, so I'm not as sad about it as I should be.
It's been a pretty good week so far. I mean, the Carlos Correa call-up is pretty exciting. It feels like there's almost nobody left in the minor leagues at this point. It feels like every big name that we've kind of been talking about for the last 2 years is now up with the big club, so it's exciting time for prospects.
Yeah, it really is. It's been a big last two to three weeks for call-ups. It's been exciting to watch. I have Vincent Velasquez on the TV right now, so that's a thing. It's always exciting to see the fresh faces make some impact. But we're gonna have to come back and talk about Harvey at some point. I don't think that's gonna be today, but. I mean, there was an awful lot of excitement right at the beginning of the season in April, but you know, we talked about Harvey looking like Harvey's production looking like 2012 Adam Wainwright, and that looks like it might just about happen.
Well, you know, it's funny because I think with Noah Syndergaard, you know, he's getting BABIPed, and I know that term gets overused, but you look at him last night. And it was just a lot of singles and just a lot of, like, not hard contact. That was not the case with Harvey. You know, three home runs. He's given up 12 already this year. And, yeah, I think that people just kind of expected him to be the Matt Harvey of old. And I think he's going to have a solid year, but it's just not going to be that, like, dominant year that people were expecting.
Yeah. But there's nothing wrong with that. A non-dominant Matt Harvey is still an awfully good
pick. And he's going to be dominant again. I think it goes back to the Wainwright comp. I think that for some guys coming off of TJ, it's that second year that they come all the way back.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You talk about guys' command being the last thing to come back, and that doesn't always manifest itself in walks. It's really about missing your spots. And when Harvey's got awesome stuff. But when he misses his spots, he misses in places that people can hit the ball hard. And when he's on his game, he doesn't put the ball in those spots. So it's, the difference between the expectation of the walks and the expectation of the really good command is just is worth remembering.
I think it's a pretty small, like, razor-thin margin between that truly elite top five pitcher status and then just being a top 20 guy, and I think that's kind of what we're seeing with Harvey this year. I don't think there's 10 guys you'd rather have, but, you know, he's just not quite there yet to be that top five Clayton Kershaw historic season type guy yet.
Yeah. We are, well, we didn't come here to talk about Matt Harvey, but, you know, it's Matt Harvey. What do you want? We are going to kick things off. You can read us at baseballperspectives.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And George is at George Bissell. It's two S's and two L's. Email us, flagsflyforever@baseballperspectives.com. And rate and review us on things that you listen to stuff on. We are going to start off, as we always do, with Expert Fab. And there was a lot of action in Expert Fab this week. So, Mike, where do you want to start the festivities?
So Joey Gallo went for 45 in Labor Mix, which is where we're going to start. And that's a pretty big bid. You know, I didn't look at this before I wrote this week's article, but he went in the high 20s in both of the Tout Wars mixed leagues, which are also 15-team leagues. And, you know, he went to James Quintong of ESPN.com. I'm not really surprised by that bid just because I understand, you know, James is at the bottom of the standings. And, you know, we've talked about this the last couple weeks, Brett. We were in that position last year where you have to kind of throw Hail Marys to try to do something. So I think it's a sound bid from that standpoint. But it puts James in a position where he's really low on money, and pretty much this has to work out. Like this has to be a case where, you know, he stays up all year and hits like 15 to 20 bombs, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with Gallo is that he's the kind of guy who, if you are lagging behind, you want to take a chance on. I mean, there's no one else coming that is freely available that has the potential to hit 20 plus home runs the rest of the season. Nobody. That guy does not exist. It may very well not happen, but if you need power, that's it.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, the guy that like everybody, you know, kind of thought this year, and we're talking about a more like polished, you know, player who's a better fantasy bet for this year, you know, probably for the future too, but definitely for this year, you know, is Chris Bryant. And, you know, Chris Bryant came up and everybody was like, you know, he's going to be great. He's going to be amazing. And then he didn't hit home runs, and now he is. But you kind of look at him, if he played a full season, he's on pace for like to hit in the low 20s in home runs, which is good, which is really good, actually. But that's kind of the high level of success. And Gallo really is not going to have that level of success because of the strikeout rate. And because of the fact that as good as he could be, he's still raw. And I think that's the thing. You know, people are just looking at those home runs he's hit, and they're incredible to look at. But there's enough holes in his game that even if he sticks, I think the batting average, particularly in a mixed format, is going to cause some pain.
Yeah, it's it's a different – they're all different profiles. I think, you know, Bryant's certainly a better natural hitter than Gallo is. And – you know, I think he spent the first couple of weeks just kind of getting the feel of major league pitching. I mean, Gallo's a little bit different. Gallo has one speed, and it is bombs. I mean, he goes up there and he swings super hard. That's why he's got a pretty strong approach. He's got a little bit of a long swing, and he just puts a ton of power in it. So even the difference between Bryant and Gallo is that even a bad version of Gallo, I think, can still hit 30 home runs over the course of the season. Whereas there are iterations of Bryant where that doesn't happen, even with his strength and his power.
Well, I don't disagree about that as Gallo's ceiling. I just don't see that happening this year. I think even if the strikeouts come down a little bit, you know, right now he's about a 45% rate coming into tonight. I just don't see him falling much more, you know, 35-40%. That seems kind of like the low end for him right now.
Yeah.
His BABIP is 500. That's impossible. That's not going to continue.
Well, I think in today's game, you're seeing more batters strike out at a higher rate than ever before. So I think the strikeouts kill you less, unless you're in a points league. But I'd be interested, Brett, maybe long-term, looking at Gallo, do you think it's good for his development that he's up in the majors right now, or do you think he's a guy who maybe should go to AAA and it would be better for his development?
Yeah, in the long term, I do worry a little bit. I don't love it when guys with a lot of swing and miss skip over AAA, just because you kind of have to get used to seeing the junk that you see in AAA when you get to the major league level, because, you know, there's a big difference in velocity and a big difference in quality of breaking ball, but you really, I really feel like you get more used to seeing major league breaking balls by seeing, you know, the constant barrage of breaking balls that you see in AAA. And it's, I don't think it will be an issue. I think he'll get time in AAA. So I'm not all that worried about it. But if he does stick for a while, it's a little bit of a concern. It's not anything that I would, you know, grossly change his valuation for in the long term. But I wouldn't. Guys like him in a perfect world, yeah, I would like to see him get AAA experience.
Yeah,
we've been on a bunch of guys. We've been pretty long, Gallo. We've been six. You know, I think in part. You know, we kind of talked about this on the show, and I mean, it's not going to be a big secret. So any other experts listening, you know, I don't care. We're probably going to bid pretty significantly on Carlos Correa this week. He wasn't eligible to bid on. You can't stash in labor like you can in tout. Carlos Correa actually was taken very cleverly by Chris Liss of RotoWire about a month ago. I forget what his bid was, but it went all the way down to one with Vickery. So he's had Correa stash for close to a month, which is, you know, brilliant. The other guys that we bid on, we bid a dollar on Joey Butler as a backup. He went for 13. We bid two on Will Middlebrooks. We missed by a dollar, and he went to three, also to James Quintong of ESPN. We bid one on Michael Taylor. He went to three, Fangraphs sleeper in the bust. And we wound up getting Aaron Hicks for a dollar, who we have in the lineup this week. With Will Myers coming back on Thursday, by the time you listen to this, he should be back. Hicks will kind of be a safety play on our bench.
Yeah, I'm excited about getting Will Myers back. That's going to be a fun one.
We've been, you know, I want to knock on wood, but, you know, with the exception of Adam Wainwright, we've been pretty lucky with injuries in that we haven't had a lot of them, and the ones we've had haven't been the significant, oh, God, this guy's going to be out for 2 months. They've kind of been of the minor variety.
Yeah, it's you know, the Wainwright thing obviously hurts, but
it hurts.
How long is Myers out for? Like 4 weeks?
3 weeks, maybe 3.5. Yeah.
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 I mean, the thing about Wainwright, you know, and we talked about this earlier today, is, you know, again, you know, I think George mentioned this. You know, I know this isn't a, you know, it's not a FIP league or it's not a WAR league, but Gerrit Cole, Jacob deGrom, and Jake Arrieta heading into tonight, and Arrieta will probably go down with tonight's outing, but 3-4-5 in the NL in WAR. I mean, they've carried us. They've kind of made us almost forget that, like, Adam Wainwright was part of our team.
Yeah, they've been exactly what we were hoping they were.
Yeah, I mean, the flip side is if we had Wainwright, you know, even pitching, you know, to a 2-7, 2-8 on top of those guys, we'd pretty much be dominating. But you just, you know, you can't look at it that way.
No.
So the other... You know, the other guy that we got was Wellington Castillo. He went for three. We got him back. So now we have Derek Norris and Wellington Castillo. And I think Castillo will do fairly well in Arizona. And, you know, in a league where you have to carry two catchers in a 15-team league, he's definitely a must-own.
Yeah, he's certainly a substantial upgrade over Andrew Susek, who was just not playing. I mean, I liked having Susek in there just on the off chance that that other Buster Posey or Brandon Belt got hurt, but you know, having a guy who's actually going to play through 4 days a week, I think, is far more helpful. And I've always been sort of a believer in Castillo. I think he can hit, and I just hope he gets a chance to show it in Arizona.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I've always agreed. I like the bat. I mean, the average is a little bit low, but he definitely is a solid hitter. You know, I think something that hurts him in the real game is I think both the stats and the perception of him as a pitch framer are below average.
Yeah. Yeah, he certainly has his flaws overall, but you know, I think over in a full season, I think he's still capable of, you know, hitting 250 to 260 with 15 homers.
Yeah,
I think that's reasonable.
Yep, I would agree.
Yeah.
The other guy that I think might be worth mentioning is Pedro Strop. The Cubs bullpen situation at this point is really interesting, and Strop went for 9 to Ray Murphy of Baseball HQ. We didn't bid because as I mentioned last week, and we now know pretty much for certain we have 4 closers, and Carson Smith is actually on our reserve list, and we kind of have to decide if we're going to play the 4 closer game and really try to make a run in saves, or if that puts too much risk to us at the strikeout category. It's kind of a, you know, Rob Paul, pay Peter proposition. Try to say that 3 times fast. I understood the bid when it came out, because at that point it looked like Strope might be the closer. But now it really looks like it could be a committee. The Cubs signed Rafael Soriano. And I don't know if you guys saw this. They were tied today to John Papelbon in rumors as well. So really a dynamic situation. And Joe Maddon, when it comes to closers, he's definitely not afraid to kind of just switch things up as he sees fit.
Yeah, it's a good situation to make small speculations on in the short term, but and $9 isn't, if you have a decent amount of fab at this point, $9 is not a huge amount. I mean, we've seen closers who have gotten into the job go for, you know, 30 plus in this league. It's a reasonable bid, and I think the odds are that Strope gets 3 to 5 saves before the Cubs do something, and they might not. I mean, Strope could go out and pitch really well for the next couple of outings, get some saves, and kind of establish himself there. I think he'll have the best chance to establish himself there out of the rest of the guys in that pen. And I also don't love Rafael Soriano anyway. I think he's getting up there. I don't think he's a lock to get. I don't think he's a lock to get that job. I mean, it's not a Jose Valverde situation where he's a terrible pitcher, but he's certainly no lock to be the closer.
Well, you know, a couple other things. You know, one is that, so, you know, just to kind of, if you haven't seen this, although by the time you listen, you probably will have, the Papelbon rumors were kind of the usual rumors where, you know, and this is just so kind of silly, but it's the way it goes. You know, the Phillies are willing at this point to eat a lot of the money to get back better prospects. And the Cubs and the Blue Jays, who are the 2 teams tied to him, and this was in a Ken Rosenthal Facebook post, were basically like, well, you know, we don't want to give up the prospects, and we want the Phillies to eat the money, which is kind of like, well, you know, good luck with that, guys. I mean, obviously it's going to be one or the other. You know, you're not going to be able to get this both ways. So nothing might happen. I mean, I think Papelbon moves at some point at the deadline, but you know, the deadline is still over a month and a half away. We're talking about a lot of that can happen between now and then in terms of teams falling in and out of the race, in terms of what happens with the Cubs. The other thing is, I will say, as much as Maddon's reputation as an innovator, if you look back at his history in Tampa, he always stuck with a guy. He wasn't that kind of manager who said, okay, I'm going to do a committee. You know, it was Kyle Farnsworth 1 year. You know, it was some other guys other years. He will choose somebody, and I agree with you, Brad. I think if he does, they do move away from Rondon. I like Strope over Jason Mott, without a doubt.
Yeah.
I'll take Justin Grimm.
Oh, gee.
Wild card.
are you watching him on TV right now?
Oh, is he in right now? No.
He's in the game. He's on my TV right now.
He's good, the Grim Reaper. It's the Joe Maddon factor. I mean, he's a wild card. He'll throw a curveball at you. I'm telling you, one of these days.
Let's let's move. Do you guys mind moving to the AL? I know we normally go to the NL, but I think the AL, just because of the big guy who came in this week, is a more interesting thing to talk about.
Sounds good to me.
Let's do it.
So Mark Trumbo, he went for $83 to Lore Michaels. Lore bid 89 with Vickery, so Vickery helped him out a little bit, but not so much. Obviously, you know, I didn't go back and look to see if he had any disabled list reclaims or traded for fab, which is something you can do in Tout Wars as well. But regardless of you know, if he did those things, that's still a, you know, that's a big boy bid. You know, that's a huge bid to add a guy. And, you know, I talked about this in my article on Tuesday, but I want to get your feedback, guys, and you in particular, Brett. So Lore was in last place entering the week. and his team has all sorts of problems, which typically happens when you're in last place. But, you know, in power in particular, he's suffering. Do you like the idea of placing the big bid on Trumbo, even though he's not an elite hitter? Or do you kind of look at it like, well, if I have this many holes, I'm kind of better off saving my fab and trying to pick my battles? And then, you know, say Johnny Cueto or Cole Hamels or Carlos Gomez comes in, you get a better player 5 or 6 weeks from now, and hey, maybe things look better.
I, you know what, if there are really that many holes on the roster, I don't. And honestly, I wouldn't even hold out for the deadline, guys. I think, you know, I think you have to try to spend it in some creative ways if you're really trying to make a big push. I mean, Trumbo is a low on base guy with he doesn't have elite power, and he's going to Seattle. And you know, unless you're Nelson Cruz, going to Seattle does hurt you. It's just you know, I certainly understand it. I would probably choose to go in the other direction, though.
See, it's funny. I'm on the other side of this, and I mentioned this in the column. Two of the four owners in the bottom third did the same thing. And one of them was Andy Behrens of Yahoo, who didn't have a lot of fab, so he probably looked at it like, well, I'm not going to get him, so I'm not going to waste my time putting a bid in. But another owner, Steve Moyer of Inside Edge, he had 81 in fab, and he didn't even bid. So both philosophies, I think, are valid. I think there's something to be said either way. The point that I made is that there was a year in NL Tout, I think it was 2012, where Steve Garner of USA Today was sitting on a pile of money. And there were players that were, I don't remember the players that year, but there were players who were rumored to be coming in. And everybody thought, oh, this guy's definitely coming in, that guy's definitely coming in. There were no trades from league to league that year. The big guy was Travis Snyder back when he was a bench guy and he came to the Pirates. And Steve bid 83 on him just because he had been sitting on that pile of money. So I've kind of seen it work both ways. And I mean, that's kind of the other side of it, which is, maybe Johnny Cueto gets traded, but maybe he goes to a National League team. Maybe the Phillies sit on Cole Hamels for, you know, the reasons they've been sitting on him and go, you know what, we don't like the offers, we're not getting an elite player, we're not making a deal. Maybe the Brewers try to trade Gomez but have the same proposition that with Hamels, which is like, well, we're not trading him for B-level guys. So I see both sides of it. I kind of see why you would kind of try to be creative, as you said, Brett, and kind of pick your battles. But I could also see why Laura would be like, you know what, even if I still have like 10 or 15 or whatever he has left in fab, I'm just going to make the big play here and roll the dice. And, you know, going against the grain of everything you said, hope that Trumbo is productive enough and say a $10 to $15 player and only, or 15, you know, to 20, that makes a difference.
Yeah. You know, Mike, I don't have the experience that either you or Brett have in these expert leagues, but to me, I like the strategy. I like the bid. I just don't like the player. I don't think Trumbo, a lot of what Brett's saying is right, that if Safeco, it's really going to be a factor for his power, you're not going to get the type of impact you're looking for when you spend this big of a fab allocation on a single guy. If it were a different guy, I'd be more likely to wait and see if another big name comes in if I still had that much fab left. I just don't think Trumbo is going to make a big enough impact for Laura's team to just come all the way back from and plug all the holes in one move.
I mean, one of the problems with redraft leagues, and I've unfortunately been in this position in town like 1 or 2 years, when you fall this far back this early, and Ron Chandler, you know, formerly of Baseball HQ, now Chandler Park, he kind of studied this. He said that if you're, I think, in fourth place or lower, maybe it's fifth place or lower, you have like a 20 in a redraft, you have like a 25 or 30% chance of winning. Like, your chances are really low if you don't get off to a good start. So Laura's kind of in that position. I think that no matter what he does, it almost isn't going to matter. And, you know, nobody, that's kind of the elephant in the room with a lot of these leagues. Like, nobody ever wants to say that to somebody. Everyone wants to be like, oh, you've got a chance. But, you know, it's June 10th as we're recording this, that there are a lot of teams in these leagues, like probably at the bottom 2, 3, 4 spots, that don't have a chance. You know, anecdotally, there's always a story of some team that comes back. You know, I've done it before in my home league. I'm sure you have too, Brett. I'm sure you have too, George. It's just really hard to do in an expert league.
It is. I mean, it's really hard to do anywhere. It's
yeah. In a home league, it's hard to do. In an expert league, it's next to impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two years ago in Taut, when I finished second, I came back because I had all these hitters come back from injury, but I wasn't in last. I think I was like in sixth or seventh, and I charged to second. You know, if you're middle of the pack, you can do it. If you're at the bottom, it's where you're just really out of luck.
I agree.
So NL, because I think the only, I don't really feel, I know he went for 19, but I really don't feel like talking about Hanser Alberto all that much. Can we skip him?
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy who's going to lose his job to Rougi Odor when he comes back up. So,
I people in the industry read this, so I was nicer about it than that. But yeah, that's pretty much the way. So, Junior Lake in Taut Wars NL. If you read the column, I had some things to say that ultimately had nothing to do with Junior Lake. It's just one of those funny situations where I dropped him because he was kind of fringy, and then he went out and played a bunch, and even though his numbers weren't great, when a guy plays a bunch in an only league, it's kind of a nice thing to get those at-bats and those runs batted in, and et cetera. The guy that I did get who had a really nice outing on Tuesday was Jorge De La Rosa. And people who are faithfully listening to the show know in Taut Wars, it's one of those funny situations where I bought Kershaw. I thought the pitching would be strong because of Kershaw. The pitching's been mediocre. The hitting has been terrific, and I really had worries with my hitting when Devin Mesoraco went down, when Yasmani Tomas was demoted to the minors. And I've kind of been streaming guys on the back end. I streamed Jeremy Hellickson for 4 starts, and he's been terrific, inexplicably. And this week I decided to kind of hold my nose with the De La Rosa start in Colorado against St. Louis because he has a start coming up at Miami. But he was terrific, and I don't know if either of you saw it last night, but he looked really good.
I did not, but I did not see the start, but he certainly it certainly looked the part in the box score.
Well, you know, he had a hand injury earlier. You know, I haven't faithfully watched him, but when I have seen him, he hasn't looked sharp this year. His stuff, it looked like he was kind of struggling through something. And it's a whole thing with De La Rosa. You know, I don't know if you guys know this or not, and I kind of tweeted this out this morning. He's a weird reverse split pitcher where he's better at Coors than he is on the road. And I'm trying to find it on my Twitter because I tweeted it earlier. And unfortunately, as I think you guys know, I and listeners know, I tend to tweet a little bit too much. But
I don't know how you're going to find it.
To put it mildly. No, I did find it because I know how to do searches. But he has, since 2012, you know, wins and losses are wins and losses, but he's 22-4 at home with a 3.54 earned run average. And that includes this year where he, up until last night, he stunk at home. I can't quite explain. You know, someone who responded to that said that it's because he doesn't really throw a lot of breaking stuff. You know, he's a lot of fastball, like a lot of cutter, you know, a lot of pitches where he's not having the same, you know, he throws a change, you know, not as much impact as somebody throwing a curved slider. I don't really know if I buy that. But, you know, the point for picking him up in an NL-only format is I think he's not necessarily a streamer where you're like, well, I'm not going to start him at Coors. I think depending on how things go with him, you know, I might kind of leave him in and kind of try to ride the hot streak a little bit.
I think in NL-only, I think that's the right play.
Right. Mix, he's a streamer, and Mix, maybe you don't even touch him. Yeah, NL-only, I think you kind of just ride him for a while. And, you know, it's funny because Steve Gardner, who I mentioned before, picked him up or drafted him. And it's weird to me he dropped him because Steve kind of has owned De La Rosa, I think, like every year going back like 4 years.
So were there any other guys in NL bidding that we should cover?
I'm trying to think. Did I get anyone else, or was De La Rosa the guy that I – if I got somebody else, it was for a dollar. No, he was the only guy I got. I bid low on Lake and didn't get him. Joe Ross – I guess we could talk about it. I was a little surprised he went so low, but I think we talked about Brett earlier in the week, you know, it's kind of an unknown, like, if he even gets that start, or if he does, you know, how long he's going to be up.
Yeah, I think there's a non-0% chance that that he's got exactly one more start left in him this year at the major league level. So, you know, Ross has nice talent. I don't think he's quite ready to contribute, even if he got more than one start on a regular basis. But yeah, I'm totally on board with this low bid here.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, Manny Benuelos at two, I think in an NL only is kind of an interesting little stash play. I don't know if he'll be up, and you know, just reading some of the Baseball Prospectus scouting on him, you know, definitely not the velocity he once had, but he's definitely, from what the scouts have said or our scouts have said, he's definitely pitching more as opposed to just throwing and you know, trying to lay it in there.
It's going to be a battle between him and Matt Whistler to see who gets the next spot in the Braves rotation.
Yeah, and Whistler was stashed last week. Yeah, that's the funny about the Braves is that they're really, you know, once they got rid of Cahill, they don't seem to have the openings you would have expected them to have. And Williams Perez is up, so, and he's done pretty well. Openings always occur, but at the moment I don't really see anything that's kind of, you know, screams out that, you know, definite, you know, opportunity next week or two.
Yeah. It'll come though. Always does. Sure.
You know, the other thing in the NL I will say is that it's interesting to me that a lot of these Colorado pitchers are getting picked up. You know, Chris Russo went for four, Vickery bit of seven. People are definitely a little bit less afraid of these Rocky starters than I think they've been in the past.
Yeah, I get that. I'm still a little too scared of them, but
well, it's for, I mean, it's format dependent too. You know, it goes back to NL only. I think in mixed, I don't know if any of their front five is somebody I would really even consider as a streamer. Even De La Rosa, who I think could be good. You're still playing with fire in this case.
Yeah, I would think unless it's a really deep mixed league, the only Colorado pitcher you're rostering is John Axford.
Yeah. Yeah, even their setups, you know, at one point their bullpen was kind of strong, and, you know, Rex Brothers was somebody who was intriguing. Now it's like, you know, Rafael Betancourt, who I hadn't touted for a week and fortunately reserved last week for the disastrous week that he had, and then I cut him this week. Yeah, I mean, just not really guys in the bullpen, even in an only, that you kind of want to have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you guys surprised at how well Chad Bettis has pitched so far?
Yes.
I'm a little, I'm not shocked. I'm a little surprised. I do think that he strikes those pitchers first time around the league who could be okay. I saw this today with him a little bit. I think hitters are eventually going to catch up to him. And it was almost emblematic today. First time through the lineup up until Carlos Martinez, he looked great. Second time, you could kind of see the hitters getting a read on him. And he has good separation, you know, in terms of velocity between his fastball and his off-speed stuff. But that's great, but none of that stuff is impressive enough to kind of make up for that. It's just kind of meh or a little bit above average.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and with a guy who pitches in Colorado, there's so much downside. It's really playing with fire. I mean, he could be pitching well for four or five starts and then go out there and put up, you know, a 9-earned run outing, and you wouldn't be surprised at all.
Well, he flirted with a no hitter against, you know, in Philly, which that park isn't as much of a hitter's park as people think, and, you know, against a bad lineup, which their lineups this year for the most part have been bad.
Yeah, the one guy who I want to talk about just for 5 seconds, literally, is David Hernandez of the Diamondbacks. He's back. He has always had really good stuff, and their bullpen is a disaster. So I kind of like that bid. I think Phil Hertz got him for a buck. But it's and you know, it's a strong bid when Tristan bids on him too. So,
we'll mention Tristan every week, but you know, Tristan, I'm looking at right now. Well, now I've fallen half a point out of first, but so Tristan's 9 points out of first, and he's the guy, like, no offense to the people ahead of him and to Ray Guilfoyle, who is ahead of me we're talking. Tristan's a guy I worry about every year.
Well, he wins every year.
He's won 3 times in a row. Yeah.
I picked up Robbie Ray just because Tristan has him.
That's a good policy.
Yeah. All right. So that'll do it. There was a lot to talk about this week. So
yeah, we got through it pretty quickly. We're getting better at kind of condensing the show.
We did. So. we're going to talk a little bit about, well, you know, I'll kick it out to Mike. Mike, why don't you introduce our sort of topic or top? Well, they're interweaved topics, but talk about our topic for the week.
Well, they are kind of interweaved, and you know, this came up because there were some other non-baseball prospectus experts talking about this online, and you know, Ray, who I just mentioned, was actually one of those experts, and I think there's always, there's two different philosophies, but I noticed from people who are experts who don't play in keeper or who play mostly in redraft, they have this like reluctance when they give advice about dumping. They'll say it's too early, and they'll say it's too early even right now. And I always kind of, and Ray and I disagreed, and I always have kind of had this belief of like, well, there's two things. First of all, it obviously depends on your league because it's market dependent. And, you know, we talked about this with our trade topic last week. You know, Jeff Quinton always of BP always says this, and it's true. It's so league dependent. You know, some leagues teams start dumping in April or late April, or early May. Well, I think that's too early. If you sit around and wait, you might kind of be like, you know, game of musical chairs. You might be left standing up while everybody else has made their trades. And the other contenders really, you know, aren't going to be able to help you out because they're capped out or other rules kind of limit you. And it can certainly go the other way. I mean, there's leagues that for whatever reason that all the dump trades kind of happen right at the deadline or close to it. But I think generally speaking, to me, there isn't a wrong time to dump. I think if you see that your team isn't contending, and it's not just where you are in the standings, if you see that you're middle of the pack, but you don't see a lot of opportunities to make it up through trade or make it up through guys coming back from injury, or you have guys overperforming where you're like, well, I know I'm in seventh place, but this just doesn't feel like a seventh place team. This feels like a 10th place team. I think you do what's right for your team. I don't think you worry about the perception of the league that you're dumping too early.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we talk about on this podcast that's league dependent, just because, you know, we talk more about overall strategy than about, than I think a lot of other podcasts. But you know, even if it's not the exact transferable knowledge that you can put to your league, I think that concepts are helpful. And you know, talking about what constitutes a good dump trade and when to start thinking about it from both sides is something that I think everybody in a keeper league deals with, no matter the depth of it. But you know, are there instances where you would expect people to be dumping already, or are we just starting to enter that now? If you're thinking about dumping in the next week or two, are you going to be the first guy on the market likely?
Well, I think again it depends on your league. In my home league, the one home league I'm left in, nobody's dumped, and there's one team that probably should be dumping, and it's really weird because it's this like super tight race, which we almost never have. It's a 4x4, but there's still 8 teams within 10 points of each other from first to eighth, which even for a 4x4 is tight. And the guy at the bottom is way at the bottom, and he really has an opportunity to kind of run the market because no one else is really going to dump right now because it's so tight. So if I were him, I would be kind of working the email and really trying to get people to pay him maximum value for what he has from the standpoint of like, look, you know, it's so close that no one else might dump this year. If they do, it's going to be right at the deadline at the end of July, beginning of August.
Yeah, we kind of talked about it on last week's show, but just because you're dumping, it has sort of a negative connotation to it, but that doesn't mean you have to decimate your entire roster in a keeper or a dynasty league. You can make one big move, trade off one big asset to kind of get a couple of smaller pieces that'll set you up going forward in a better position for the next year. It doesn't mean you have to sell off every single piece you have and try to completely bottom out and restart. I mean, that's a really desperate situation when you get to that point when you realize you just don't have anything except one player. Well, but if you have a couple of good players, it doesn't make sense to get rid of all of them. Maybe just choose one to get rid of right now.
Well, that's a really good segue, George, because, and this is kind of to use a term Brett talked about last week, there definitely is that difference between Dynasty and Roto. And Roto, you don't necessarily want or need to sell off all your pieces, but if you do, there's not as much harm in it because of the rules and because of guys having to get thrown back and contracts and what have you. You're right. If you do that in Dynasty, if you completely retool, I don't know Dynasty as well as you guys, but from Brett has told me, you could be looking at like 2 to 3 years of just kind of wandering in the wilderness, without a doubt.
Oh, easily, yeah. And it's a much different proposition. I mean, you can completely dump in a keeper and compete in the following season. I've done it, Mike. I'm sure you've done it. It's
yeah.
It's just a matter of finding the right, figuring out the guys on your team that you don't need, and figuring out the right targets that other people have. But the point being that, you know, I guess moving on to the sort of the next phase of this is when you've decided to dump, and it works the same way when you've decided to, you know, trade some usable future pieces to go in for this year. How much attention do you pay to getting the perfect deal versus getting the right deal, if you know what I mean?
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Okay. I'm talking about, you know, when there are a lot of times where owners will kind of imagine a package that they think they should get for, you know, for player X. Say I have, you know, player X who was a top prospect who's a $5 keeper, and I should get, you know, a solid number two starter and a power bat for him. Having those expectations and, you know, but talking to owners in the league, finding out that that's not where the offers are, what the, you know, the difference between taking the sort of best offer that you have after your due diligence, or waiting to see if teams get more desperate and waiting a matter of, you know, a week, 2 weeks, and possibly not having it happen at all.
I tend to go on the side of taking the deal I can get. Now, obviously, it depends on, you know, the deal. There is a certain floor, and this kind of alludes to what George is talking about. Like, if you make a deal where your trading guys are expensive, or you know, in a draft league where they slot in, like, top-round picks, and you're getting a guy that really isn't bringing a lot of value back, and somebody's like, well, take it or leave it, you don't want to do that, because that does put you in a position where you're not going to compete the next year. But if it's a deal that's improving my team for the next year, and I'm giving up guys where the contracts are running out, or they were inflation buys that I'm not going to keep anyway, I don't like waiting, just because I often find that the market kind of is what it is. Like, teams sort of make their decisions. They don't a week later come back and say, well, you know, now I'm willing to pay you more. Like, that, theoretically, that should happen. But I find that if that does happen, that happens during the cycle of negotiations. What I will say is, something I try to do when I'm dumping, I see teams, the biggest mistake I see teams make when they dump is they either take the first offer, or they're dumping for 3 or 4 days. They announce it and it's out there for 3 or 4 days. But then, with almost no communication with anyone else, they make a dump deal. And the reaction of the whole league or half league is like, I would have done better than that. When I dump, I try to stay in contact with everybody who's contending. And I pretty much will, during the process, say, you know, without saying what the deal is, look, you know, I'm not doing this to rake you over the coals. And people know I'm fair-minded, so they know I don't do this. But I've got a better deal. And, you know, your offer to me is, it's good, but it's not going to get you there. And because I'm fair-minded, people know that I'm not, you know, doing it for the sake of doing it. And they know when the deal I make, you know, is done, even if they don't love it, they're like, well, I could see why you made that deal. You didn't just make a stupid deal, Mike. So to answer your question, Brett, yeah, I tend to take care of all that in the first round of negotiations and don't put myself in the position where I have to wait and wait and wait.
Yeah, that makes sense. I tend to do the same thing. I think you kind of back yourself into a corner when you kind of start negotiations with multiple teams, and you tell those teams that you're looking for X and you haven't gotten X, so you're not going to move forward on a deal. Then when those teams see that, oh, you haven't made a deal with any other team in, you know, a day, 2 days, a week and a half, you're likely not getting whatever package it is you're looking for. So then it, you know, there's a little bit of, when you're aggressive about it, there can be a little bit of blood in the water from the other teams that can then look at it and say, okay, you know, maybe I don't even need to offer as much as I was offering before in another week or in another 2 weeks, and it creates a slightly different dynamic than you're looking to create.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, and I'm sure Dynasty and Roto are the same as far as this goes. You have some years where, and some leagues too, you've got some years where one team dumps and then, you know, everybody else dumps. Now, I try, and when I see people do this, I shake my head. I try not to, if someone announces they're dumping or it's obvious they're dumping, I try not to announce at the same time because it's like, well, why would I get into the fray with somebody and, you know, turn it into, you know, buyer's market? But I've seen people do that. I've seen people... Someone announces like, "Well, I've got better keeps, so I'm going to announce two," and it just hurts them. But that's somewhat it's dependent on. If you've got two or three people dumping at the same time, it can really dilute the market. And if you're contending, it's great for you. But I've seen it go the other way, where like a league, it's almost a one at a time situation, where one team dumps and everybody is trying to get those players, not knowing when the next team is going to dump. So there's some of that element as well.
One of the things that I noticed a little bit, Mike and Brett, is that if you're contending, if you're trying to win, you can find young guys, you can pick up prospects, and you can kind of deal those guys to the teams that are looking to rebuild and maybe get some useful veteran guys back. And it goes the other way, too. If you're looking to rebuild, you can pick up veteran assets, closers, and trade those to contending teams and maybe get back a little more than you would in a normal situation.
Yeah, the trading thing takes on a different phase. I was actually having an interesting conversation with Mike Salfino the other day. We're in there's an expert dynasty league that I'm in with him. We actually made a trade that, you know, is a dump trade for him, not a total dump trade, but a partial dump trade. And his take on it, which I found pretty interesting, is he thinks that the best way to get deals like that done is to take a slight loss on the first deal that you do, but get a deal done. Then that gets the other owners I guess, more into dealing with you because they think you're serious. And then kind of make it back on the other deals. That's never been my approach, but I thought it's always interesting to hear different people's strategies. And, you know, Mike's a, you know, I've been in the league with him for a while. He's a good player. You know, he certainly knows what he's doing.
Smart guy.
So, what?
I know Mike. He's a smart guy. I know Mike from like online. He's a smart, actually, I met him once in New York. He's a smart guy without a doubt.
Yeah. No, I've met him a couple times. He definitely is. It's one of those things that seems counterintuitive, but when you see it in action, you know, it's probably not my cup of tea, but I get it. And, you know, for my sake, I'm competing in that league, and I happen to be the first person that he made the trade with. So, you know, I like that trade from my end, but it's a, you know, I thought it was a relatively even trade anyway. I traded for Joey Votto, and I like Joey Votto, and then he hit three home runs, so that made me happy.
That's always nice when that happens. You know, it's years ago.
He's pretty good.
And I'm just reminded of this because of Chris Heston's no hitter. And the hit by pitches, you know, I call it a roto perfecto because, you know, if you don't count hit by pitches, it's the same as a perfect game in fantasy. I traded for Kevin Brown in 1997, the day before he had a game like that where he had a no hitter where the only runner was a hit by pitch.
Yeah, I have my own story like that. I traded, I think it was maybe the second year I was in. I was in my home league that I still play in now. I traded for Sean Green the day before his four home run game.
I think we both shared these stories on the show, but
we might have. That's my.
Since George is new, and I'm not even sure he was, you know, like you know, he was probably like not even elementary school and these things happen. Great. This week's history lesson, it's about baseball and not television.
Yeah, I did my book report this week, Mike. You should take it easy on me, all right?
Right.
I streamed the Dallas Braden no-hitter. It was the weirdest no-hitter ever. But
yeah,
that's the only one.
That was a weird no-hitter.
Well, I had Phil Humbern in AL only, and you know, when he had that perfect game, and I was actually out that day, so I didn't get to see it. But people who like play casual fantasy were with me, were like, why would you own him? And I'm AL only. They're like, why would you play AL only? It's like, yeah.
Well, that's a fair question. But
I kind of wanted that sometimes.
Yeah. So was there anything else you guys wanted to cover on this topic?
Nope. We're good.
I don't think so. I think that was a pretty good, you know, lively discussion. And you know, we should let our listeners know, because we haven't seen one in a while, that you know, you guys can send questions to us, you know, and we have a mailbox, and I think it's out there when, you know, George puts this up. So by all means, like send us questions. We're fine, like, just kind of coming up with our own topics. But this is a good time of year if you have questions for us to answer them as well.
That's true. We love your questions.
Or the bat signal.
That too. Right.
Sure.
Questions. Send them to flagsflyforever@baseballperspectives.com. We will look at them. We may very well use them as topics on the show. So with that, let's take a quick break and close things up. Thank you for listening to episode 57 of Flags Fly Forever. We have been a Baseball Prospectus fantasy podcast. Go to Baseball Prospectus today and check us out. Become a premium member, read all our stuff, become a super premium member, get access to the bat signal along with all the contest, with all the con, all the contest, with all the con, wait, what word am I? With content, content, tent, content, tent, like a big tent. Yeah, so bat signal, ask us questions, we'll get back to you in about 12 hours or less, and you will have all of the fantasy answers you could possibly desire. Again, email us, flagsflyforeverbaseballperspectives.com, and we will see you next week. Good night.
Hey, everybody.